we have the MEBA, which is the Marine Engineers Brotherhood Association. They're both divisions of the AFL-CIO. Our deck officers are not, and then the shore team is not. We have four tankers. They end-to-end, they're huge. They're about as long as the Empire State Building is tall. So that's who we are. Multi-employer unions, lower pay. We pay less than the average, but we have better working conditions. So that's what we do. This is our history. The x-axis starts from 1999 till now. On the y-axis is the gallons of oil spilled. And you'll see when we started out, we had spills for the first 2 or 3 years. We've not had any crude oil spills since that time. In that time, we've carried 1 billion barrels of oil. And the behaviors that produce good environmental protection, provide good safety protection. This is our safety statistics. We've gone 18 million man-hours with one lost time injury in 2011. One of our workers broke this knuckle of his. He's back to work. So that's our safety performance. So it's been quite a ride, and I was going to talk a little bit about what we did to get there. We wanted to be the safest tanker company in the world, and we wanted to be seen to be the safest tanker company in the world. So we have 9,000, 14,000 certification. We have EcoPro. This is something that the Department of Ecology in Washington State has. The best operations prevention, operations maintenance, technology and manning standard. It's a voluntary thing. So in this discussion this morning, I noticed there's a lot of discussion on regulatory requirement with the implication, I think, that all a company has to do is meet the minimum requirement. And for me, in our journey, that was completely misplaced. I think that what the regulators do is a reflection of societal forces. And those are very, very strong. The railroad has not gone through any of the bad experiences we did, like the Exxon Valdez. But I can assure you that if there were an incident of that kind in this room, it wouldn't matter whether you're a regulator, a tank manufacturer, a railroad company, or an oil company. We'd all be under the bus. I think the story of Bakken is going to last with us. It's going to be with us for decades. And to my steer would be in these formative stages of regulatory environments and compliance that be on the front foot rather than try and react to it. Much of what I heard this morning sounded to me like people looking inside their own function. I love working in Alaska Tanker Company. Inside Alaska Tanker Company, everyone does what I say. But, you know, the question is, how useful is that? And the reason I'm showing this slide is that actually what you have to do is form partnerships. We've got two awards from this body, Legacy Awards. One of those awards was sponsored by the Citizens Advisory Council out of Valdez, the 18 communities that were affected by the oil spill. We've been recognized by our unions twice, on the East Coast as well as the West Coast. We've received commendations from the Alaskan legislature, and of course we're very proud that because we were the first tanker company to get the Coast Guard's Osprey Award for environmental performance. So, I mean, the reason I'm saying this, team, is that, you know, you don't have to be as an oil company or as a regulator, like, who's that guy who carries the whole world on his shoulders?
Atlas.
You don't have to be Atlas. Form powerful alliances. Form teamwork. Have the courage to create common ground. Someone didn't like that. So, what did we do? What is the basis, the principles under which we run? That purple outer circle is called operations integrity. By far, the most important thing in tanker operations, perhaps in railroads, is operations integrity. You know, no one's going to believe you give a two hoots about safety or anything if the tank is kind of the tank is kind of falling all over your ears. This requires deep technical knowledge and a passion for excellence. That is by far the most important thing. Within that, there are three other circles. You have to have excellent systems and processes. You have to have a very strong preventive maintenance program. You have to have a strong safety system. You have to have very clearly defined roles and responsibilities. It is teamwork, but in the end, you know, what is the responsibility of each entity in terms of the railroad, the oil company, or the company that makes the tanks, the tankers themselves? Everyone's roles and responsibilities have to be very clearly defined. And by far the most important thing is behaviors and relationships. And this is a story of and. It's not a story of this or this. If you have all of that, then you are in the middle of that space which we call quality performance. There's no substitution of behaviors and relationships for good systems and process, at least in my view, or in our journey. So, as far as regulators are concerned, this will just take one more minute, Mike. I think our most effective interactions with regulators, what did we value? It changed over time. So when we started out as an average company, what I needed from my regulators was enforce the requirements, be the policeman, issue NOVs, admin orders, fines. That created for me, within Alaska Tanker Company, the environment in which I could get the funds to create a truly safe company. You know, if you don't meet the rule, here's the fine. That's what I felt the regulators needed to do in the initial stages of our journey. Then after that, as the efficacy in the company, that we really started believing we can actually run without incident. We would be surprised if someone got injured. I'd be very surprised if we had a spill. As that performance improved, it required a lot of teamwork from within Alaska Tanker Company. But from the regulators, what we received and appreciated was, you know, forums like this, where there are shared lessons learned, where there's a focus on prevention. We have, every year we review our safety management system. We review all the incidents we have. And we invite our external regulators to that. And I'm very proud that Tom Cullen, Dale Jensen, and Larry Hartig from ADEC made time to attend. We had the Coast Guard come in from both Portland as well as Seattle, and many times District 17 in Juneau. So we open our books, we review our safety management system. Whatever's wrong, everyone sees. It's a totally unvarnished look at the internal organization. And what it does for me, is it makes my company understand how important what we're doing is. Total transparency is the summary of that comment. And where we are now in our journey, there aren't, if you look at the Exxon, BPs, Shells, the big companies which have very, very strong systems process, they'll get to a certain injury rate, but they can't penetrate that. Well, we've been at zero for 10 years. And that's a totally different conversation. That is what we're exploring now. How do we battle complacency? And the answer to that is through mindfulness. But I won't talk about that because I'll take too much time. So I think that's all I had. Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, so that kind of sets the ground for a company improving on their safety and then managing it for a number of years and having the record that Elastic Tanker Company is capable of doing. Now we're going to hear from Dan Riley. Is that right, Daniel Riley? You want to just stay there?
Sure, this will be fine.
Is that good? Okay.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. actually is a small personal story. I had the opportunity to address this group a number of years ago before I joined Tesoro. At that time, the conversation was around more on your end of the world, Emil, the need for more controls in the Puget Sound around tanker escorts and dedicated resources. And it took a long time, a lot of work by this group, especially those in Washington State, but we made a lot of progress in that space. And I think we have a safer marine transportation system today because of those strong discussions that we had at that point in time. It's also a pleasure for me to be here. I spent the last 8 years in San Antonio, but was transferred back to the West Coast earlier this year. And this is a very special part of the world, the whole West Coast. And I was going to go in and explain a little bit about our company, but I think Rick did that very well this morning. Just a couple points that I'd like to add to that is, and one is worth repeating, is that Tesoro has grown through acquisition. Many of you are familiar with us because of where we are in your areas. We really operate in the footprint of the state's BC Task Force. We have six refineries, four of them are in the state's BC Task Force areas. And it's really our two small ones in North Dakota and Salt Lake that are not. So we understand what it takes to operate in this environment. And I think that understanding, and I'd like to describe a little bit about our company philosophy, is key. What we understand is there is an expectation on the part of the public that we responsibly handle virtually every drop of raw material and finished product that we manufacture. We think we're up to that task. We had a change in leadership 4 years ago, and our new CEO is a very driven person, but he pushes his value system down on all of us. We have a set of what we call our guiding principles. I'm going to back up. There was one point that I did want to mention. It's primarily for Rich Berkowitz. We also have a Marine Department within our organization. We do charter and spot charter marine vessels. They are all Jones Act vessels, Rich. That was amazing. But we have a strong marine group. I'll come back to that. So our guiding principles. First, we have core values. Our core values are around honesty and integrity and protection of personal safety and the environment. And that's critical to what we do. We instill that value in our people. Second is that we have excellent people. We like to think of ourselves as a high-performing culture. We have to have exceptional people to deliver the kind of products that we do and do it in a safe and environmentally sensitive way. We have a shared purpose. We understand the direction that the company's coming, and we all move in that direction. Also, we're driven towards superior execution. Much like the similar philosophy to Emil's, we have to deliver quality every day. Because of the type of raw material and product we handle, we have to be very, very good. So we do that with superior execution. We do that, we protect our people, we protect the environment, and at the end of the day, you know, hopefully we deliver some value to our shareholders as well. And the last guiding principle is powerful collaboration. It takes a lot of effort to run an organization like this where you have so many different moving parts, some of which are equipment related, many of which are people related. So we have powerful collaboration within our organization. Just a couple other points more direct to the things that we talk about here in the CSBC Task Force. One is safety. We are absolutely committed to the safety of our employees, the contractors that work for us, and the public, the people that surround our facilities where we operate. One of the things that we say is we operate at the pleasure of the community. We get it. We have to. Also, I'd like to comment briefly on spill response and preparedness. The key for a company like ours is in preparedness. In this forum, we worry more about spill response, but we put our emphasis on preparedness. We do that in many different ways, through mechanical integrity, through inspections, through training, through use of technology, but we need to be in a position where we prevent spills from happening before they occur. If they do, that's when it's important to have a good, strong spill response program. And the way we do that is through drills. We do over 3 drills a year in our company. We do it through the relationships we have with some instances, the people in this room. It's important that we know each other in good times, because if we have an incident, we don't want to be meeting for the first time. But we need to be prepared also through our relationship with our OSROs, so that we have the right resources in place to respond. And the last thing I'll touch on in terms of prevention is on the Marine side, is we have a very robust vetting program. Because we do time charter vessels, we have different vessels that call on our fixed facilities. We need to make sure that the operators and the equipment that we bring into our locations are up to snuff, if you will. So our Marine Department is responsible for our vetting program, where they look at the history and the insurance and the operability and the physical layout of vessels before we ever bring them into our facilities. You have to make sure that they fit correctly. So with that, I'll turn it over to my rail friends.
Okay. Thank you very much. So what I think I've heard from the first couple of speakers, and having spent most of my career in public service, where our greatest asset are our people and the people that we work with, our relationships and partners, I think I kind of heard a lot of that internally within their own organizations. They're operating a lot of mechanical things that need to work right, but it's the people operating them, and they're trying to do that safely as they can, and treating their employees really well. So now we're going to have just one opening statement from the rail industry, if you will, and Danny Simpson from CN Rail has agreed to start us off on that, and then we'll move into somewhat of a facilitated discussion.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity to be here with you this afternoon. I know my offices are in Chicago and Montreal, so it's nice to get out to the West Coast every once in a while, even if it's in the UP and the BNSF's backyard. But obviously the reason CN is here is because we have a significant presence in British Columbia. And of the Class 1 railroads, we're probably the only railroad that has a truly significant operation in both the U.S. and Canada. So one thing that I'll say, in case I forget later on, one of the most important things for a carrier like us, in order for us to meet our customers' demands, is that all of these regulations that are being potentially promulgated, that there be some degree of harmonization on both sides of the border, because if there is no harmonization there with all these looming regulations, that could really adversely impact the North American economy. One thing I wanted to mention is that there are 9 Class 1 railroads in North America. There are 2 in Canada, 2 in Mexico, 7 in the U.S. And they truly are, in this largely landlocked North American continent, the backbone of the North American economy. Virtually everything that we wear, sit in, sit on, drink, eat, drive in, use, is shipped by rail. Essentially, the rail network in North America is that land bridge that facilitates worldwide commerce through, into, and out of North America. When it comes to hazmat or dangerous goods, and I may use the terms interchangeably, but they're synonymous for today's discussion, hazmat being the sort of American nomenclature, and dangerous goods being the UN rest of the world nomenclature. When it comes to that, the average Class 1 railroad moves probably 9 to somewhere around 14 or 15% of its, what it moves, the commodities it moves, are hazardous materials. And collectively, the railroads probably move somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.2% of what they move currently is crude oil. So I think we've all read stats, heard stats, been inundated with stats, but even though 99.998% of railroad shipments reach their destination without incident, the reason we're here today is to talk about the 0.002, Lac-Mégantic being a perfect example, which really is the primary catalyst to a lot of the task forces, working groups, proposed notices of proposed rulemaking. There's a lot of activity in this post-Lac-Mégantic era, but that's really the main reason we're here, is to talk about those instances where there is an accident or a train derailment, and there's the requirement for a response. Keep in mind, for I know most of you know this, but some of you may not, the common carrier laws in both the U.S. and Canada require that a railroad accept a package that is properly secured, classified, and identified. In other words, we can't reject a shipment. So even if my particular railroad or any of the other Class 1 carriers said, you know what, we only move only 1.2% of what we move is crude oil, we don't want to move crude oil anymore. It's just too much political sensitivity surrounding crude oil. There's no way we could do that. We have to accept the package and we have to move the product. Another thing, for some of you that may not know this, is that tank cars, which Pat and some of my colleagues will be talking about as part of what's going on in the crude by rail or railroad industry, are not owned by the railroads. They're owned by the shippers. We are kind of like a UPS. We move the package, i.e. the tank car, from the shipper to the consignee. And that's important because that's why you hear a lot of news about collaborative efforts between the rail carriers and the American Petroleum Institute and the Railway Supply Institute, because that triad, that alliance there, that group that's working feverishly on some of the new tank car proposals, for instance, it's required to have all three of those at the table, because the railroads move the cars, the shippers load the cars and own the cars, and the Railway Supply Institute, the RSI, are the builders of the tank cars, and in many cases, the lessor of the car. Because oftentimes, an ExxonMobil or a British Petroleum or a Dow or a DuPont doesn't own the car. They lease the car from a tank car manufacturer who has a lease fleet. So if the actual owner of the car is the builder of the car and it's part of the lease fleet, that brings them in as a key stakeholder. So just a couple of facts that some of you may not be aware of. Everything that has occurred since Lac-Mégantic, regardless of what side of the border it's on or in what context it's being worked on, really falls into three buckets, if you will. And I'd like to try to put those into three buckets and then turn it over to Pat to sort of walk us through what's going on in the railway industry in these three areas. Bucket number one is, what can we do to operate trains more safely? This is where you hear about the discussion, whether it's speed restrictions or car placement or distributed power or two-way end-of-train devices or EPC brakes, all of those types of things, track inspections. That's one bucket. That's the operating practices side of it. The second bucket, if you will, is the container itself. We've already heard numerous speakers allude to the DOT 111 or the tank car that crude oil is shipped in. So we'll talk about that. There's a lot of activity there, and the railroads obviously are a huge stakeholder in that piece. And then the third bucket, which is another primary reason why we're all assembled here today, is the emergency response component. How can we better prepare ourselves to respond, and how can we enhance our emergency response capability, leverage the key emergency response stakeholders' resources as a force multiplier, if you will, to better protect North America's railway infrastructure. So with that in mind, I'll turn it over to Pat to talk about each of those three categories. And Jeff and I may chime in, but we'll let Pat sort of facilitate that. And one of the reasons that you're not going to hear three Class 1 railroads each give you a 10-minute spiel on what they're doing is because, as was mentioned earlier, we're federally preempted. We're regulated by the federal government. And therefore, what you'd hear is essentially three variations of the same thing. The railroads, by the sheer nature of federal preemption, operate very, very similarly So I'll turn it over to Pat.
All right, Danny, thanks. So I've never tried this before. I'm going to operate without a net. So I want everybody in the room, and we're going to talk about some different type of oil right now. So everybody in the room that owns a vehicle, automobile, raise their hand. Does everybody raise their hand? Okay. So, keep your hands up. No. So everybody who only changes the oil in their car because there is a federal or state requirement to change your oil in your car, put your hand down. All right? So if you only change the oil in your car, because if you don't, if you have a, if it's under a warranty, you're going to lose your warranty. Put your hand down. So some of you only change your oil because you're going to lose your warranty. So there's a lot of people in their hands that keep putting hands down now. So where am I going? Why do you change the oil in your car? Well, it's easy, because if you don't change the oil in your car, you don't maintain your car, what's going to happen? Your car's not going to work. Okay? So whenever I'm in a group like this, kind of I'm always struck by we talk about regulatory compliance, and as Anvil was saying, is that regulatory compliance is really the minimum standard. So we say and we move hazardous materials 99.998%. So 99.998% of the materials go from origin to destination without ever having a problem. The reason why that is so low is not because of regulatory compliance. It's because of the extra regulatory things that we do. So if we only met that minimum standard, our accident rates would be a lot higher, our release rates would be a lot higher. So the question is, well, why do you go above the minimum standard? One, it's the right thing to do. We're moving hazardous materials through communities, through environmentally sensitive areas. We are a good representative of our company, so we want to move those materials through there safely. The other thing is money. A derailment of a unit crude oil train and could be in excess of $100 million in damages and cleanup costs. Poison or toxic inhalation hazards, if we derailed one of those and release, could be $1 billion. So it is our requirement, not only for the owners of our companies and the communities that we operate through, to do it safely. So some of the extra regulatory things that we talked about, and the buckets that Danny talked about, is that track inspections. So normally on our key routes, which would be crude routes, we do track inspection two or three times more than required by the federal law. And that is visual inspection. That's using non-destructive testing methods to actually look at the rail, to look for flaws, find a broken rail before it happens, a thermal misalignment, that type of thing. Mechanical inspections, we do inspections at terminals before the trains leave, but it's not good enough. So along the route, we have what we call fail equipment detectors, and we utilize technology. So as that train goes by, we're monitoring things like bearing, temperature, the sound, the acoustics of the bearing. We're looking for flat spots in the wheels. So we utilize the technology to find, again, things that would cause a derailment, like a broken rail, a broken wheel, a fail bearing. And then finally, when you look at what causes derailment, human factor. So humans cause derailments by not following the rules. So how do we make sure that occurs, that they're following the rules? So we have what's called event recorders in our locomotives, very similar to a black box in an aircraft. So when those locomotives get to a terminal, that information from that trip is automatically downloaded. And so a computer looks at the trip, and they know what the perfect trip is as far as rules compliance, horn, brake, energy use, diesel fuel use, and it bumps it up against the perfect trip. And when they find rules violations, the train master, the supervisor, gets notified, and our engineers are licensed, and depending on the severity of the violation, they could get their license taken away. So again, prevention, we want to keep the trains on the track. A little bit about mitigation. You know, Danny talked about the different type of tank cars. They're all DOT 111 tank cars. There's the CPC 1232 variety that we heard some of the speakers talk about. And then there's the legacy DOT 111. For BNSF, moving
crude oil in the Pacific Northwest, about 70%, greater than 70% of the tank cars that we move in the Pacific Northwest, the CPC 1232. But then you got to break that into two different groups. There's CPC 1232 jacketed thermally protected cars, and there's CPC 1232 non-jacketed thermally protected cars. So you also heard some discussion on the notice of proposed rulemaking and the comments. And so what the Association of American Railroads and the American Petroleum Institute, the API, combined comments were, look, we think that even the CPC 1232 cars need to be retrofitted with thermal protection and jackets. So that's a combined comment. And it's interesting because when you look at comments from states like Washington State, they recommended no retrofits for CPC 1232 cars. So it's important that the railroads are an API, our customers are looking at not only the minimum requirement. Remember, the minimum requirement now is a DOT 111 tank car. The AAR push for the CPC 1232, again, above the minimum standard, and now we're pushing it one more step farther with a retrofitted CPC 1232 with jacket and thermal protection. And the final thing I want to address is response. And we heard different things today about basic and comprehensive response plans. We're required to have basic plans unless we move over 42,000 gallons per tank car. But that doesn't mean that we don't have comprehensive plans. Again, extra regulatory. The reason being is if we had a spill on a river, it is our financial responsibility and responsibility to the state to clean that up. So it's a lot easier for us, a lot quicker and cheaper if we have comprehensive response plans for those areas. We do a lot of training within the communities. We train about 25,000 responders per year industry-wide. That's firehouse training that we go out and actually meet with the responders at their location, provide that training. We're developing a crude by rail computer-based training program so we can provide DVDs or a computer link to every fire department if we can't reach, again, those 25,000. And then the railroads have dedicated $5 million in 2014 to send 1,500 responders to a three-day crude-by-rail class at the Security Emergency Response Training Center in Pueblo, Colorado. We're partnering with the federal government, PHMSA, Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, put out a crude oil job aid that the railroads, through TransCare, have provided comment and information for it. One of the speakers today said that the railroads do not provide hazmat information to communities. I can't tell you how wrong that is. We have been providing hazmat traffic flow information by Association of American Railroad Standards for over 10 years. Some railroads for more than 10 years, 20 years. So we provide a listing of the hazardous materials that go through the community, not only crude oil, but all the hazardous materials that go through a community. The final thing is hazmat equipment. All the railroads that are represented in this room have industrial firefighting trailers located through our systems, spill response equipment. We have some of our hazmat contractors here in the room that some of them are OSRO contractors, some of them are other providers for us that we pre-approve, we audit their capabilities, and we rely on if we have an incident. Thanks.
Thank you. That was actually answered some of the questions that I had thought that I would key up. But I think one of the clarifications that I have is that really the rail owns the units that pull the cars and the rail that it rolls on. Do I pretty much have that right?
That's correct.
So, and within, I think Pat had said that 70% in the Pacific Northwest are the CPC 1232s. And I also didn't really ever really understand how that all works with the rail manufacturers or car manufacturers making a lease fleet, and then other customers are actually leasing those and asking you guys to move them. What can you guys do to put pressure on either the customers that lease those or the companies that have the that build those and lease them out to people to step up their standards maybe sooner rather than later?
Well, I think Pat hit on some of the key aspects of those three buckets that I defined earlier, but we can kind of go a little bit deeper into one or more of those buckets, and the tank car issue is a good example. In 2011, the Association of American Railroads Tank Car Committee, through the interchange rules, and an interchange rule basically means that if I'm going to interchange a car or a shipment from CN to BNSF or BNSF to UP, that car's got to be compliant to the interchange standard. And that's what was alluded to, I believe, by one of the speakers earlier when he or she couldn't quite remember the date, but it was October of 2011 that the AAR promulgated a new interchange rule which said that if we're going to have a general service tank car, a DOT 111A 100W1 tank car, in interchange service, it will be of the CPC 1232 variety. And really what that means is that that non-jacketed, non-head shield protected tank car that's just basically a 7/16 inch thick, giant sort of 24,000 gallon drum on wheels would turn into something with half head shields. The tank shell thickness would go to a half inch from 7/16, or it would receive an eighth inch jacket, and then it would also have double shelf couplers on it to prevent coupler override and subsequent puncture of a head. That was in October of 2011, and the AAR petitioned the federal government to make those standards a bit more stringent. Now, both federal governments in Canada and the U.S. were working on that when Lac-Mégantic occurred. So everything that's happening was in the process of happening and has been expedited given the recent incidents, and is moving along at, I would say, record pace if you consider the speed with which, with all due respect, the federal government operates. And that's a good thing. The thing that we are doing is we have been, since Secretary Fox met with the CEOs of both the petroleum industry and the railroad industry and the RSI. We've been working collaboratively with the API and the RSI in a working group on those tank car standards. And even before the notice of proposed rulemaking came out from PHMSA, which sort of showed what the federal government was thinking with respect to the tank cars, our working group had already decided on what it thought that tank car ought to look like. And you'll see a lot of that, or you would have seen a lot of that, in the comments, some of them joint, between the railroad and the API, that have been filed in response to the notice of proposed rulemaking. Bottom line is this. You will see significant changes in all three of those buckets brought about by not only the Secretary Fox call to action, but brought about by a lot of working groups that have been convened by the industry itself. So, you know, we're already reducing speeds of what we call key trains to 50 miles an hour if they meet the definition of a key train. And we're already reducing the speed further to 40 miles an hour for any train that contains a legacy 111 through a high threat urban area, as defined by the Department of Homeland Security, Portland being an example of a high-threat urban area. You'll probably see a tank car, even though the government can't comment on it, rightfully so. I can't because I don't work for the FRA, but the odds are you'll see a car that's very similar to a pressure car, thicker than a general service car, with full head shields, full jacketing, double shelf couplers, thermal protection to protect it from flame impingement, as well as top fittings protection. That is a significant enhancement over the Legacy 111, and the conditional probability of release of that car has been reduced by over 100%. So that's a good thing. Now, there was some talk earlier about retrofitting these cars and can we do it quicker? The reality is we could retrofit all the cars very quickly if we put a stop to the North American economy and we didn't move crude by rail at all. We could do it probably in a couple of years. But the fact of the matter is there is a finite number of tank car shops. Those tank car shops not only have to build new cars, 50,000 of them in the queue for crude oil service alone, yet to be built, but they also have to recertify existing cars when they come up for certification. So you've got recertification and requalification, you have new builds, and you have this aggressive retrofit, which the railroads have lobbied for quite some time now should be as aggressive as possible. But the reality of this is we're not going to be able to change the North American tank car fleet, 275,000 general service cars, overnight. It's going to take some time. The key, which will be embedded in the new rule, I'm sure, is how do you prioritize that retrofit? Which cars do you retrofit first? Do you do the cars that carry packing group 1 flammable liquids with lower flash points? Do you do the cars that are maybe in unit train service, regardless of what their flash point is? Those are the things that have been hotly discussed and debated in the rooms of however many different buildings across North America since Lac-Mégantic. So this new rule that comes out will shed some light on that, I'm sure, in Q1 or Q2.
Dan.
Okay, if I understand your question, it was 70% of the cars in the Northwest are the newer design, and 30% are the older. How do you facilitate that transition? And I'm going to repeat something that Rick Wine said earlier. You know, we looked as Tesoro at, you know, what was happening in this space and you know, what the public was saying. And so in February, we made the decision that the cars that call on our Anacortes refinery in Washington State would only be the newer CPC 1232 car. And understand that design will be outdated sometime in the near future, but that is the best design today. We accomplished that turnover by June. We had phased out the older 111s that were part of the fleet that calls on our refinery. And so today the cars that come through this area and then up toward Anacortes that go to our facility are all the newest designs available today with the 1232 cars.
So that brings up kind of a question, something I heard earlier this morning. So if a someone orders up 107 car load to be hauled and they find two of them or there's something wrong with them, it sounds like your company would be willing to take the shipment of 105 cars. Does that sound right?
So when you say something's wrong with them, meaning that it doesn't meet...
Some reason they took it. I can't remember just exactly how it was phrased, but for some reason they had to take a couple of the newer cars out of service, and it was implied that they might put a couple substandard cars in with that. So it sounds like...
So that in reality, that really doesn't happen. So all the shipments for a Tesoro unit train are Tesoro unit train. So if there's some cars that do not meet the DOT requirements, FRA requirements for movement, they're set out of that train and they get repaired and next train they get put on it. So you don't take some older cars and just throw them in there because they're not leased by Tesoro. So it's a little bit more complicated than just, you know, filling the train with some older cars. That doesn't happen.
That's I think one of the dangers and then one of the reasons why we're here is to, you know, from my layman standpoint sometimes of trying to figure these things out, and really appreciate you guys being here to explain a lot of this to me. So another observation is, so, and this task force, obviously we have two Canadian-U.S. borders that we've dealt with transboundary issues and things like that on in different areas. Currently it looks like the Canadian rules may say that as far as requiring comprehensive plans would be any consist containing a tank car, if I read that right, and whereas this potential for U.S. to go with, say, 20 cars, if that were to happen, how does that affect your exchange of trains and things like that?
I think it's a little bit, it's a bit early to guess what the Minister Rates consultation that she issued and the PHMSA Notice of Proposed Rulemaking that was issued. It's a little too early to sort of guess as to what they might look like and whether or not they might be different. The reality is this. I think both Minister Rate and Secretary Fox realize that this is not only a North American tank car fleet, if you're talking about rail cars, but it's also a North American emergency response initiative. And I think when it's all said and done, the planets will line up a little bit closer and there'll be a bit more harmony, simply because there needs to be. Because with respect to commerce, that border is virtually transparent and it needs to stay that way in order for the North American economy to flourish. So I think that'd be a great question after the final rules in Canada and the U.S. come out.
Okay. Yeah.
And I would add to that too, the rules in Canada versus the United States for spill response planning is a little bit different. So in Transport Canada requires the shipper to have the emergency response plan and file it with Transport Canada, where in the United States it is the transporter, the railroad that has the emergency response plan. So it's a little bit different, so it's not totally apples to apples.
Well, sticking with comprehensive response plan, so our experience, and we've dealt for several years with the different rail companies, part of the requirements for the comprehensive plan for the comprehensive plan currently would include the qualified individual or that type of equivalent, as well as a commitment to spend the funds to respond to a worst case spill. So from our experience, we already have seen that pretty well demonstrated by the rail companies. What are the other things then, moving from a basic plan to the comprehensive plan, that you guys might see as challenges?
Well, I think one thing, if you reference 40 CFR and you reference part 112, I think it is, that's really geared more toward a fixed facility. And I heard some people on a previous panel talking about changing the definition of a fixed facility so that the railroad square peg could be put into the fixed facility round hole. And I think one of the biggest concerns we had is the North American rail network, if you reference the map that we had on in the beginning, is a very dynamic and fluid transportation system. It's even different than pipeline. And the emergency response plans that we've had in place to comply with both OSHA and the CFR 29 and the Canadian TDG regulations really take care of most of the sort of post-OPA 90 type of spill plans that fixed facilities have in place. The one thing where we may have to stretch a little bit is stationing resources across the network to be able to meet, you know, whether it's the 6-hour response time, so that those resources can be brought to bear. And that's where the railroads are already kind of trying to get ahead of the game, and they're collaborating, and they're taking a look at the North American rail network as a single system. And so when Pat buys, whether it's a foam trailer, you know, with a large diameter eductor and foam concentrate, or I'm buying one, we're working with one another to ensure that those resources are placed to protect the collective system, and we don't have redundancy in one place and a lack of resources in the other. And that's evidenced by one of the projects that the AAR is working on, which is an actual North American rail system map that'll be available to the Department of Transportation that shows where those resources are. So those are some of the things that we're kind of wrestling with at this point, not knowing what the final rule in this advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, which is separate from the NPRM I just talked about, not knowing what that's going to look like. We have yet to file comments for the ANPR.
So the other struggle that we have is because we operate in 27 states, it would be hard for us to, every time you cross the state border, you have a different spill response plan requirement. So we're happy that the DOT is kind of filling that gap in their advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, and we would like to have more standard spill requirements from nationwide.
So I think one of the ideas discussed in the advance notice for rulemaking was the idea of rail corridor planning. And so is that what you're alluding to as far as just your staging of resources? Is that type of planning?
It is. We already have a tool in place, the rail industry does, called RCRMS, which takes 27 safety and security factors and weights them and applies them to an analysis or a comparison between two routes on a single carrier's network. So in other words, if you have a spider web looking network like Union Pacific in the West or BNSF, you can take a look at two routes and you can apply those 27 factors and determine which one is the safest and most secure, because it'll pump out a weighting for each of those two routes. That tool is already in place. But it doesn't really meet the need of a single corridor risk assessment, and we're working on those tools and conducting those risk assessments in order to try to come up with what would be the railroad version of a GRP or a regional spill plan.
So speaking of GRPs, and of course we're all natural resource, or most of us are natural resource trustees, and protecting waters in Oregon, groundwater is also one of our concerns, and one of our jobs is to protect. So in those factors, and I'm kind of going down to the pipelines were by PHMSA required to identify environmentally sensitive areas along their pipeline. Are those some of the types of factors that go into the 27 that you were just talking about?
In the individual route analysis, these receptors are factored in. And of course, there's a little bit of discussion and debate as to the definition of navigable waterway. That's an ongoing issue right now. But we're sort of caught up in that 40 CFR world that historically we've not had to function in, because we've been more of a 49 CFR DOT regulations and 29 CFR OSHA regulations. So it's kind of a little bit of a new world for us, but we'll have to work through it, because we'll have to file comments on the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which is really based on 40 CFR.
Okay. Just one more question for me, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience if they have any questions. And I guess Hillary can do what she did before. And so that question would be, now Washington talks a lot about best achievable technology, and so how can we take that into a preventative, we've talked about the tank card standards. Is there anything on the horizon maybe that you guys are looking at that could improve the track monitoring, rail car monitoring to a kind of that it isn't being necessarily required or talked about in proposed rulemaking?
Yep. One thing about the rail industry that's not widely known, because most people don't delve into the rail industry, is that the Association of American Railroads, which is the trade organization that represents the rail industry, has a 52-square-mile test facility in Pueblo, Colorado, Transportation Technology Center. In my past life, I worked 14 years for the AAR and headed up their Hazmat Services Division. But what they do out there is they test those technologies that you're talking about, and they do that with funding from the Class 1 railroads under strategic research initiatives. So things like high-speed rail flaw detection that looks into rail for subsurface deformations, those are the types of things that are tested at that facility. And when the results of those tests bear fruit, then the investment comes back in the form of an ROI, and the railroads start to implement that. So things like hot wheel detectors and other types of wayside detection, high-speed ultrasonic rail flaw detection, these are all things that were tested and funded by the railroad industry and then came back to the industry after the AAR tested it successfully. So those are things that are going on right now.
Okay. All right. I guess we'll take some questions from the audience if there are some.
Hi, I'm Don Zarowski, EPA Emergency Response. I assume that unit trains are a subset of oil by rail travel. What percentage of oil by rail is not carried on unit trains, do you think?
From a CN standpoint, I can tell you that at the beginning of this year, 25% of the crude that we moved was in unit trains. That went to 35% by mid-year, and it's projected that we'll be just under or at 50% by Q1 of 2015. That's crude oil in unit train service. Keep in mind, however, that crude oil may likely be carried, and other flammable liquids may likely be carried in manifest train service, where you have different types of rail cars in a train.
So the rail companies don't own the oil, the shippers don't own the container. The oil is owned by either someone who pulled it out of the ground or someone that's going to receive it on the other end. When you pick up, whether it's two cars or 100 rail cars that have been loaded by someone up in the Dakotas, you do an inspection, correct?
That's correct.
Do you inspect the top of the car and the bottom of the car, or what all do you do when you guys pick up by federal law? What do you have to do to inspect the vehicles that they're going to haul the oil in?
By law, the offerer of the package must ensure that the package is properly secured, marked, placarded, and that the shipping papers are correct. And the shipper and Tesoro can jump in if they'd like. The shipper would fill out a piece of paper at the loading rack that showed that that was in place. When the railroad picks up the car, it's an incumbent upon them to inspect the car as well, because in the chain of custody, if you will, the railroad now has custody of the shipment and needs to make sure that it's compliant as well. So we take a look at it as well. The train crews do not get out of the locomotive and climb up on every single rail car that they pick up at every facility. They don't do that. They will look at the cars from the ground, and then we move or carry the package to its destination or to interchange with another rail carrier.
And I would just, our by volume, about 90% of our crude oil is moving in unit train operations. And as Damien said, we do inspect from a ground position. We do have what we call non-accident cause releases from time to time. That would be, let's say, a loose manway cover bolt. Normally, those things would not be found in a ground inspection, but we're typically talking less than 1 gallon of material spilled. So it's not the high volume kind of anything that would cause a real environmental issue would be non-accident cause release.
So when you guys pick up the load, the person who filled those cars certifies on a piece of paper to you that these cars are loaded correctly and the manifest is written correctly and the information correctly and it's good to go. You accept that as being correct.
They don't certify. They certify to the federal government that it is properly classified, packaged, and secure for transportation. They actually sign the bill of lading. We get a copy of that, and we move it. So if we had one of those releases in transportation, regardless of the amount for crude oil, we're required to fill out a report form, send it to PHMSA, and then that stuff gets given to the FRA for an inspection. So if a person didn't properly secure the car, there is a mechanism that the Federal Railroad Administration would do follow-up inspection, probably issue citations.
And what I can tell you, having spent some time in our facility in the court, is that we have a program to inspect each car when it comes in. And it's, for a non-railroad person, it's pretty interesting. So we have a contractor that's there. We can, if there's a problem identified with a car, we can isolate that. We pull it off into a separate area, and we can do whatever, a contractor that can do whatever maintenance is necessary on that car, and then put it back in line, or we'll add it to another train down the road.
Any questions? On the retrofitting and building of new tanker cars, you said that was going to take a while. What is there a projected date, or are we talking years or decades? Or
we're certainly not talking decades. Our comments as a rail industry have always been that we're in favor of an aggressive phase out of the legacy DOT 111. In our dealings with the API and the RSI and trying to figure out how to match up capacity with new builds, some of the dates that we kind of came up with were that we could probably retrofit the legacy 111 fleet in 3 years after ramp up. Ramp up would probably be about 12 to 16 months, and that was based on the RSI's self-inspection of their capacity, factoring in requalifications and new builds. I don't know what the actual number is going to be, and I wouldn't want to be quoted as saying that's how long it'll take, but I would say less than 10 years and somewhere in that 3 to 5, 6 year range, depending on what type of retrofits. Are we only retrofitting the 80,000 non-jacketed legacy 111 cars? That takes a certain amount of time. If we're, in addition to that, going to retrofit the non-jacketed CPC 1232s that Tesoro has already opted to use, that would take some additional time. But it's our thinking, just based on where we sit, that all of this could be done in certainly less than 10 years, somewhere in that, let's just call it that 3 to 6, 7 year range, depending on what you're retrofitting.
I wonder if we can put that in perspective a little bit. After Exxon Valdez, how long does anybody recall what it took to get to all double hull tankers?
This year?
So that would be pretty impressive, too, I think. So.
First of all, I want to thank you for actually responding to my question to the first panel about cooperation of railroads concerning the response. To that, you mentioned a foam maker and equipment. Do you also stock chemicals like oil cleanup products or firefighting chemicals, or only the equipment?
Most carriers are fairly similar, but when you're talking about a firefighting and or vapor suppression operation, the local fire department has the ability to move water, and it has the ability to apply fire streams. If it couldn't do that, it wouldn't be a fire department. And as a former fire chief, I know that to be a fact. So the gap really isn't in the fire service's inability to suppress vapors or put out fire. It's fighting a three-dimensional fire in a derailment scenario where part of the flammable liquid is inside of a tank car, and it's not pooled in a perfectly pristine flat pool where you can just lay AFFF foam on top of it. That is the additional training that I believe some of the previous panelists are talking about. And there may be a need, depending on the size of a fire, to use larger diameter reductors and to be able to apply a bigger diameter foam stream, more of an industrial firefighting effort rather than a municipal firefighting effort. Those really are the two gaps. Other than that, the fire services are completely capable of suppressing vapors and fighting fire. That said, what we provide on a typical foam trailer, if you will, and that's the same for UP, BNSF, CSX, CNCP, is about a 20-foot trailer with anywhere from 250 to 500 gallons of foam concentrate with a large diameter pump, unmanned monitor nozzle. These are the types of things that your small rural fire department may not have. So mating up what we have and what we can bring with what they have locally gets you the ability to address a fire suppression operation if and when you opt to do that. One of the biggest concerns as a former fire chief and current railroad hazmat officer is we've been very safe with our North American emergency response doctrine. We've had very few people injured or, God forbid, killed in emergency response. one of the things that's a big concern for me is if we aren't fully transparent with what the site assessment requirements are at a train derailment prior to mounting a fire suppression operation, I don't want to see some inexperienced fire captain mount a fire suppression immediately after a train has derailed because he or she is incapable of conducting a site assessment on a train derailment. So these are the things that we have to work with collaboratively, whether it's the PHMSA firefighting job aid that's now out on their website, or whether it's working with fire departments in the states throughout and the provinces throughout North America. That's a big concern of mine personally.
Another part of my question was spill response. And
I'm sorry. We do have 20-foot intermodal containers loaded with boom and spill response equipment. Most all of the carriers do, scattered across the system. In some cases where a swift water response is required, that might be placed closer to that sensitive receptor. I know CN, and I'm not, my AVP of environment isn't sitting next to me here, but he would tell you that we've got some 70 or 80 of those containers scattered across our system in North America.
And then our equipment augments our contractors, our Osro contractors' equipment, so they're our primary line of defense.
So I was curious, I'm sure you're aware that the states have commented on the federal rulemaking in terms of maybe gaps that they think exist in the contingency planning requirements. So I was just wondering if you could just comment on areas that you think could be improved in those in terms of the substance of them, but also getting them in the hands of the state regulators so they can be aware of what's in the federal response plans. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't, because I don't know specifically what the gaps are that have been identified by which state, so I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
How about the rest of you on the panel? Do you have thoughts on that?
You want to jump in? So, the devil's in the details on what PHMSA is going to come out and the FRA is going to come out with their notice proposed rulemaking. And again, we would like it to clear up some of those issues that from state to state that, worst case spill projections. Some of the issues that we have is when we looked at the pipeline regulations, you would think that it's apples to apples, but it's really not. So when you look at a pipeline spill regulation, is that a pipeline always, almost always has crude oil in it. So in a railroad, even in one of our major crude oil routes, you've heard some correct and some incorrect volume numbers today. So let's say you've had 12 unit trains a day. So if you look at just one 100-foot section of that track, how long does that train occupy that track in one day? Minutes, okay? So when you start looking at the probability of having a spill at that location, we look at risk as being the distance from, let's say, a river, and then how many miles that you would parallel that river or come within, let's say, 1,000 or 800 feet of that river, meaning that the risk of derailing along a river is higher than when you're crossing a river. So really trying to take, for us, 32,500 miles of track and boil it down into areas of concern from a risk perspective, risk meaning the probability of having a derailment at that location with the release, and that release getting into that environmental receptor, whatever it is, let's call it a river. So that's some of the balancing that we're trying to do. You have this huge elephant, you can't eat it one bite, so what smaller bites can we take? And we look at that as risk. So we're hoping that the PHMSA rule and the FRA rule will kind of clean that up a little bit. I don't know if that answered it or even came close, but I tried.
Thank you.
Okay, well, what I'd like to do now is just kind of run down the panel here, and we'll start with Anil, and kind of just take an opportunity, and if you want to answer part of this or none of it, just say, hey, that, you know, that's okay. But I'm just curious on, you know, what for your company, what is maybe one of the most important things you've learned last year through your operations? And, you know, or is there something about your company that you'd like the audience here to walk away with today and understand?
Thank you. Well, this is mostly about railroads. what we've been working on, which I find fascinating, is complacency. We have been unable to find any organization that has successfully documented how they overcome complacency. There's a whole field of study called high reliability organizations in human behavior. And that postulates that you really have to be nervous, you know, on edge in order to not get complacent, which we don't agree with because it's not sustainable. So we've been doing a lot of work on complacency and how to avoid it.
Thank you.
I think you asked two questions there. One is, what have we learned? I think we knew what we've learned, but we've seen it happen before. You know, when a major incident occurs, you know, like the Exxon Valdez in 1989, there's a very definite reaction to that kind of an incident on the part of the public. And you know, I started off my comments about, you know, we understand that. We've had another one of those, you know, last summer with the Canadian rail incident. So there's a very real reaction to those kinds of events, and we hear that. You know, that's the reason we made the decision to move toward the newer rail cars. The second thing I would say is that, something about our company. I explained our kind of our core values when I started out, but we also have another program called Shared Value. It's something that probably the public doesn't realize, but what we want to do as Tesoro is we want to be in a position where we can work collaboratively with all stakeholders. We want to look for solutions to problems that can benefit everyone. So I appreciate the opportunity to have some time here with you all today, because you know, the problems that you guys represent are things that are important to us, and we think that we are a major part of the solution. So I thank you for that opportunity.
I wasn't sure I was going to be able to talk to them.
Of course, you have the best one.
I thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak. I'm coming in learning for over the last year in this crude by rail in particular, need for transparency is absolutely fundamental for all of us. I feel as I get on scene and as a primary responder for my railroad in the Northwest, getting on scene and understanding the moving pieces before we actually put our boots on and show up on scene is absolutely fundamental. Getting the basic knowledge out prior to an incident, understanding the moving pieces, understanding the nomenclature on the rail cars, understanding that when I go and teach a fire department hazmat team that they are not trained per state requirement for Oregon in particular. Those guys are not trained in... my brain just went blank. Damage assessment on the tank cars. We were talking about showing up on scene and having a fire department start spraying water. It scares me. I think about that at night, worrying about the level of safety and stuff. A fire department's job is to put fires out. That's what they do for a living. When we see a fire department respond to a crude oil incident, potentially with a fire fully involved, and they start spraying water, is that the best action? A lot of times industry standard says that's not. That's options, and there's things we need to consider for that. I think getting this stuff hashed out beforehand and understanding what's going on is absolutely paramount, which goes into my second piece is training. Joint training, if we do a full-scale drill, tabletops, one-on-one training, bringing people out, climbing tank cars, understanding what we're doing for a living is absolutely a requirement for what we do out there.
So I would add partnerships. So the railroad hazmat and dangerous goods groups have always been very good partners. If we have an incident, I always hear from CN, UP, CSX, Hazmat Dangerous Goods people saying, hey, what can I help with? Do you have any questions? Do you need any equipment? How can I help? But that partnership has expanded due to the crude by rail to our customer partners. Just working with Soro, I think that our spill plans have gotten a lot better. Our preparedness has become a lot better in some of the what they taught us and what they have done at their terminals and some of their other operations. So I think that's a valuable point. The other thing is similar to transparency, just communication. I don't think it was too many years ago that you would have to get a railroad guy by gunpoint into a room like this to get in front of a panel. So again, I think we have a lot of good information to talk about and get our story out to people so they understand the facts on railroad safety. Dan?
I think the other panelists have pretty much summed it up. I would say that this post-Lac-Mégantic era has certainly resulted in stakeholders who previously might not interface very much outside of an emergency response are certainly doing so now, and that's a good thing for everybody. And I, as a responder for the last 30 years, I think the thing that I like about this is I see a day coming when memorandums of understanding and mutual aid agreements and looking at the North American railroad network as a whole single entity with respect to infrastructure protection is going to happen. I think this has just sort of served to escalate that evolution, if you will. And I think the last thing that I'd like to leave the audience with is almost without exception, when you take someone who doesn't know much about the railroad and you introduce them to how a railroad really operates, how it protects its infrastructure, how it monitors its operations, just everybody that I've ever run into leaves totally astonished at what kind of capability a Class I railroad has in its operation. And maybe there's a need for a little more communication along those lines so that the states and other emergency partners, emergency response partners, really know what kind of capabilities and what kind of mechanisms railroads have in place. Mike?
Okay, well, one of the things I'd like to do and kind of concluding is, and Danny really segued right into it. Years ago, we had a facility out in eastern Oregon that was destroying chemical weapons, and through a lot of permitting and things, and part of what they had to have was an emergency response plan. And we did some exercises with them, and you know, it took us 2 days to plan the first 2 minutes of an exercise for that facility. We really struggled with that, and then we finally decided we had to put the money up to hire a planner to just deal with that one facility. And most of us have so many facets of our job, and I think that individual learned so much in the first month that he was on the job. He learned more than we had collectively in years. So I think kind of the same thing, when you're able to focus on your job, your company, the way you guys run your system, you know, we're all looking on the outside, and all we see is that the rail is making us wait so we can get home across the railroad tonight. So I really appreciate the insight that you guys have presented here today. I hope it doesn't take a shotgun to get you here again. But on behalf of our director and the task force, one thing I've learned today is no matter what we do with this map, it's not going to stay on the wall. But I really do. On behalf of everyone, I thank you guys very much, and this has been very helpful, I think. So let's give them a round of applause.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks again to the panel. So we've reached our last break of the day. We're going to come back for the last panel and some closing remarks at 3:15. Again, I'll ask the panelists for the 3:15 session to get here a little bit early so that we can be ready to go. And